Hi, everybody. It's Jim Beekjai, and the podcast is Be You, The World Will Adjust. Continuing along that theme with the people that I've had on my podcast, I'm really pleased to have a person that I've reconnected with, known for quite a long time. He's had a very interesting and varied career and was so far way ahead of the curve on fintech and the world of technology and its impact that I thought quite timely to have him here now, because nobody would have believed him 10 years ago when I first met him. Peter Misick, who is your managing partner at Framework Venture Capital. Peter, it's great to have you here. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Jim. It's my pleasure.
You've had an interesting and varied career that got you to this place in time. And as I said to you when we were talking the other day, I remembered, it had to be 8-10 years ago when we were talking. I think you might have been at Jefferies at the time, or you were just making the move. I can't remember specifically. But this one thing always stood with me is you said to me, there are 200 fintech companies in Canada that no investment banker has ever contacted. They don't know anybody in the capital markets world. And I remember sort of thinking fintech, really fintech, you know, so on. And you were the first person that was just so far ahead of that curve. So maybe for my listeners, just give them a Reader's Digest version of your life, born and raised, school, sort of how you got to Framework.
Yeah. So family were refugees from what was Czechoslovakia. Didn't speak English until I was 6 or 7. It was a tough upbringing in the school system. The school system at the time really didn't appreciate any differential. And when you look different, talk different, and dress different, oh boy, it's tough. Worked on a farm, vineyard. Family business has been in the wine business for a couple hundred years in Europe. Father ended up doing that here in Niagara. Grew up in Niagara. Ended up going to a local university because I ran the family business while I went to school. So Brock got an accounting degree because accountants always eat. Taught myself how to program because I thought tech was the future. Got my CA. And I remember driving to work one day thinking, if I slam my car in the guardrail, I don't have to go to work today. And you know, realized, oh my goodness, I have to do something different. Got on a plane to Wall Street. Got a job at Salomon Brothers in New York. Came back, told my Deloitte partner that was happening. He's like, don't go to New York. We just bought an M&A boutique. We'll transfer you there. That started a almost 20-year Wall Street, Bay Street, City of London career that had me living in London, England, San Francisco, and New York. At the same time, when I moved to London in 2000, I helped start a venture capital fund called DN Capital with two people that I consider family. That fund has gone on and done some spectacular things. I had an opportunity to be involved in 16 investments in 15 years. Some big names like Shazam, the music recognition app, and Deca, and others. Came back to Canada in 2015 to do VC full-time and got completely humbled by how hard it was to raise money and how much people didn't believe what we were preaching was possible. And what we preach that's unique and different is that we believe in combining data with operational expertise to help remove the obvious mistakes in a startup's journey. And so in a nutshell, we are McKinsey, Bain, or BCG in a can for startups. And we are very active. And the team is very active with these companies.
So let's expand upon that. What a great background. And I share the immigrant story. So good, hard immigrant family, hardworking lesson for many, many people about why we need good immigrants in this country. But going back to your comment upon when you find companies, what's your pitch on it? Because everybody's got money, right? Everybody's got money. Back then, when you were talking about it, everybody had money, but they didn't want to spend it. Now people are inundated with money and there's cash chasing ideas, good ideas, bad ideas. But what differentiates Framework? What is it that makes that entrepreneur say, this is not just dumb money, this is, I need this to be successful?
So this is where data is super important and where having a history of performance with previous companies really matter. And I'll start at the end. We have to have alignment with the founder. They have to believe that we're going to help them avoid the obvious mistakes. And that when they talk to our current CEOs or previous CEOs and founders, that they feel like we're something different. So where we start, though, is the data. So we track 21,000 companies across North America. We have a full-time data team. They track across 65 to 100 data fields, and those data fields evolve over time. And so we can tell you what the top percentile of company in each different sector looks like, what kind of customer acquisition cost, lifetime value, what kind of revenue growth. We give all of that data we have at our fingertips. And we can tell you when you give us your data, where you score, why you score that way, and what your probability of success is going to be if you don't get involved with us. And then if you don't want to get involved with us, we'll still make two or three introductions with amazing funds that we have in our database that have agreed to partner with us. And so we ensure that no matter any time you touch any part of Framework, it's a, at worst, neutral experience, and at best, a positive experience for you, the founder. And then on our ops team, we just surround ourselves with the best of the best. And we're able to do that because we've been doing this for 20 years and we've built relationships around the world with the best chief marketing officer on the planet, the best chief revenue officer on the planet, the best CTO on the planet, the best CFO on the planet. And so we can bring those people to bear. And when people see who we're bringing to bear, they're usually blown away. Every now and then they're not. And every now and then they're like, yeah, I just want money. And there's no alignment there. So we have to move on.
So one of the things you often see and hear about is the founder's dilemma, right? The founder normally are control freaks because they're so obsessed with their product, their business, and everything else. How do you transition those people to understand that having 100% of something little versus having 10% of something huge is massively different, right? And that same sort of mindset, you know, if you think about all the greats, Gates, Jobs, every one of these people, they all started out as control freaks, right? And the majority of these people, even, you know, Spotify or anybody else, and I'm sure a lot of the companies that you work with and invest in and see, how do you get them to move, get that movement?
Yeah. So the good news is that most of the names you mentioned, I've had the privilege of interacting with individually. And so I can usually tell great stories about why they took money. And without exception, all of them did take money as a side note. And without exception, all of them realized one thing. We as human beings are not infallible. We make mistakes. And the key for any founder should be, in order to become world-class or successful, is to avoid the obvious mistakes. Avoid the mistakes that have been done before you. Like, don't go running into that wall. It's going to hurt. What if you could partner with somebody that has cataloged thousands of mistakes? What if you could partner with somebody and say, look, we're going to remove 90% of the obvious mistakes. And if we do that, you're going to be anywhere between 10 to 100% faster than you currently are. I say 10 because, you know, you don't know how much they're going to absorb. I say 100% because some of our companies, man alive, are they absolutely killing it? And so it comes down to, do you believe as a human being that you can learn from mistakes? And if you can't, if you feel like you're infallible, you're not a fit for us anyway.
So further along that point, what are the characteristics of that founder other than the, you know, believing that they're infallible? Like when you see them, you probably very quickly can assess and say, you know, that person's got what it takes. It's like when I do my recruiting, you know, or my coaching, I can tell very early on certain instincts, certain characteristics of people that are going to be, you know, malleable, pliable, to really want to absorb, and others that are just like, no. But from your perspective, when you see these people come and you've watched them, the ones go successfully and you watch them go to the grave, right? The core differences between those two groups of people.
The ones that succeed have a purpose. And that purpose usually stems from some kind of need to change the world. And it truly is to change that world. And that purpose, in Google's case, it was to categorize and catalog the entire internet. In Microsoft's case, it was to enable personal computing to be on everyone's desk. In Apple's case, it was to allow people to engage with beautiful products that are just incredibly easy to use. And in each case, that purpose was so singularly aligned throughout the organization that you could touch any part of that organization and you could feel the energy of that purpose. That energy is I don't know how to describe it, but it is real. It is profound. And when it infects all of your organization, it acts as a gigantic dynamo and it recharges and empowers everybody. It is really important, though, that when you go and you see these patterns, that you don't exclude or preclude somebody who maybe doesn't fit that exact bill. And that's why we rely so heavily on data, because the data shows those things, right? And so what we don't want to do is we don't want to introduce any kind of bias. And what we don't want to do is we don't want pattern recognition to be one white man chasing another white man's tail. What we want it to be is we want it to be to truly find those purpose-driven entrepreneurs that want to positively impact the world. That in a nutshell is the litmus factor. It's the X factor.
You know, my son Sam was at Babson in San Francisco for a term after I had a term in Switzerland. But he was there, and it's very interesting that you say what you say, because that was 2 or 3 years ago when I went out to visit him. They'd been visited all these companies and done all that stuff and done work. And that was the one thing he said is, you know, you think, Dad, that people start these companies to get rich. He said, getting rich is the byproduct. They all start the companies with a purpose. They want to make the world better. They want to do something different. They want to help the world. And I think it's an interesting perspective that I don't think everybody in the world thinks about all of these companies, right? Most people think that people go to start a company just because they want to get rich. I mean, there's nothing wrong with getting rich, but it's much more sustainable and has a broader platform if there is a purpose. You know, I was just doing some reading on vertical farming and how that's going to change, is changing the world, and it's going to change the world in so many different ways. I've said this on the podcast a million times. I wish I was much younger, and I wish I was not doing what I was doing, but doing what you're doing, just even not to make any money, but just to be in contact with these stories and the people and what's going on. So maybe you could share, I don't know if you read the book, Fareed Zakaria's 10 Lessons in the Post-Pandemic. I love the book. I love Fareed Zakaria. And one of the things that really stood out for me in the book is the historical transformation of world economies. And he talks about telehealth. But the one that really grabbed me was his comment about AI will have as big an impact on the world as the Industrial Revolution. So looking forward now, what are the themes that you see and the impact on people and economies? Because I think most people just kind of blindly going through day to day at home now. But before that, they were going blindly through day to day going to the office. And they're still not recognizing that the next 10 years have been accelerated by what's happened by probably 20 years.
Yeah. So I think the next 10 years, we'll see more change than what we've seen in the previous 100 years combined. And I believe that rate of change is going to accelerate. It's going to be driven by a bunch of factors. The first is computing power is about to explode. We all know about AWS, the cloud, et cetera. But most average person don't realize that Intel is unlikely to be powering the future of these computing revolutions in the future. It's going to be an architecture called ARM, driven by ARM Holdings. It's going to allow 100 to 1,000 times computing capability in the same space. So if I told you that in 10 years or less, there'll be a 1,000x increase in computing power, you'd probably say, oh my God, is that a lot? And I'd say, that's more than the previous 10 years, more than the previous 20 years. And so imagine the pace of innovation when you start throwing that kind of computing power at problems and challenges. That's the first thing. The second thing is humankind is going to put increasing stress on itself, and crises are going to increase at an ever-increasing rate. And the reason why they're going to increase at an ever-increasing rate is that social media, the internet, have lowered all barriers for all voices to be heard. And we as human beings are demanding more information, not less. And we're seeing history through new lenses. And it's causing the flaring up of ideologies to collide. And that conflict is going to manifest itself in a lot of ways. But that conflict is going to breed one positive outcome. I believe it'll be a positive outcome. And that'll force change. And so that will accelerate the pace of change. And the last thing is that human beings are now willing to accept fundamentally altered interfaces, altered experience, whereas prior to the pandemic, they would not have. And so the pandemic has lowered the barrier for the change of human behavior. And so all of those things combined, it's going to be a breathtaking next 10 years. I'm super positive. I'm super excited because I think we can change the world for a better. I think we can create more openness, more honesty, more transparency. we can fundamentally tell people that how you behave online is as important, if not more important, than how you behave in person. And I'm an optimist that all of those people that can't talk with dignity and respect to their fellow human being will be exposed and ultimately steamrolled to accept that being kind, being generous, and being nice is okay. I'm an optimist that that's going to change the world. In fact, I spend more time on my Twitter profile sharing positive and optimistic things than I do anything else, because I just find that social media is so negative. And if I can be one small beam of positivity in a world of darkness, that maybe will compound itself.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. The words you're using are words, as Katie knows, that I use about truth and transparency, and the world is a better place for it. With more truth and transparency, it exposes those that are nefarious or really sort of playing a second game and those types of things. So as you see the world going forward, it's going to have an unbelievable strain on the employment situation in the world. You've got generations of people out there at the early end, young kids coming into businesses that didn't exist 15 years ago. But that mid-group, that mid-generation of people whose businesses and works and all of those types of things are going to change. What's the future of the workforce in your view?
The future workforce is extremely technically orientated. I believe that some nominal ability to program is a requirement. I believe that every single one of us, regardless of age, can learn that. It's super easy. You can go to Khan Academy. You can spend, and I'm not joking, 20 to 30 hours, and you will have a rudimentary understanding of technology. The moment you have a rudimentary understanding of technology, it frees you. It frees you in that you don't have to believe that what you've always done is what's always going to happen to you. You can very quickly create a side hustle. You can very quickly try different things. And who knows? Imagine we could increase the number of people that find a true passion by 10%. What would the tone of the world be? Then let's make that 50% of the population find their true passion. You go from a world that is very angry, very upset, very bitter right now, to one that is far more fulfilled and far more positive. And so, you know, it's our singular objective at Framework to build world-class companies. Our customer is the entrepreneur and the management team. And we do that because we think by backing these wonderful companies and these amazing entrepreneurs, we can fundamentally alter the world and make it more positive. So that's our goal. And that's what I think is an ability for everybody.
You know, it's really interesting that this generation of people that you invest in, maybe because they grew up in multicultural societies, maybe because they were raised differently than the previous generation of people, but there is a real desire. It seems like the desire to make the world better has a much broader base of people wanting to do that. And then within that broader base of people like yourself, there's a base of people that want to do it, but don't know how to do it or need help in doing it, but to have the idea. And probably no other time in our history did you have the ability to actually raise the money to turn bread into beer like Toast does in the UK, or like I watched a company doing, you know, changing the price on best before day food so they could lower the price with a day or two left to it. All of these things, which just totally blow my mind and excite me at the same period of time. And as I've said before, I said the most wonderful thing that's happening is that nobody can say that won't work. But you and I grew up in a world of investment banking where, you know, or banks and things like that, where somebody goes, oh, no, that's never going to work. You know, we tried that and that didn't work, right? But today, nobody can say that. To be in a position to have as open a mind as you and your partners do, to see these people come in, it must be mind-blowing.
I don't believe I'm doing a job. I believe I'm living my greatest dream, and I couldn't be happier. And I can only say that I tell my team, I tell everybody I interact with, I wish for you, I wish for all of you that you find the passion so it doesn't feel like work. and that you wake up every morning excited to go do whatever tasks you're going to do. I watched my father wake up every morning whistling and singing before he went to the vineyards. We grew up, most people don't know this, but in the wine business, there's a great saying, how do you make $1 million? You start with 10. You grow up poor and you come to realize that if it's not about the money, everything else falls away. If it's not about proving that you're better than somebody else, everything else falls away. If it's not about telling the world I'm the greatest, it's rather about proving to yourself that you have no limits or that your limits can be explored, everything else falls away. And it just becomes a different lens to experience the world. Don't get me wrong, you're still going to impact haters and people will want to tear you down and all that other stuff. But boy, it feels different. It really feels different. The reality is that data used appropriately, used ethically, used positively can free us from the lies at which many of us been forced to live. And we as a country can stop lying to ourselves. We can stop lying to ourselves that we're all these super nice people that and don't have a dark past. We can lie to ourselves, stop lying to ourselves to say that, no, we don't have any racial biases. We can stop lying to ourselves that we don't have any gender biases. We can stop lying to ourselves that we've got it all figured out, because we don't. And it's about time that a big, bright spotlight is shone on all of us to expose all of our lies so that we can start living truthfully and transparently and honestly. And boy, what does the world look like when we all know what the honest truth of the past looks like? What does the world look like when we honestly know that it doesn't matter where you come from, what you believe in, or what gender you have, or who you love, or how you love, that the spark of the universe is in you and that spark is universal? Like, imagine what that world looks like. And technology, in my view, in our view, is going to free that. It's going to enable that. And it's so positive. It's so exciting. I can't wait to see the future.
That's fantastic. It is fantastic. And it's fantastic the way you marry those thoughts with what technology enables us to do, the transparency, the truth, the flushing out. So I wouldn't be honest if I didn't also say that I'd love you to give if my investors had some money and they wanted to not pick stocks, but sectors, and they had that money. I just had a grandchild, so I'd like to put some money away for that grandchild. And what sectors of the world at markets would you be investing in?
I make it really easy for people. And I ask them this simple rhetorical question. Do you believe that there will be more or less technology in every single industry that there is? And if you answer the way I answer, which is, of course there will be, then you can't go wrong by owning as much of the S&P 500 technology index as possible in your portfolio, and then calling it a day. Or if you want to get really specific, I tell people a basket of Amazon, Apple, Google, those are not going to steer you wrong for any length of time. But you know, there's people that worry about antitrust, whatever. If you want to just make it really simple, just make technology a big part of your portfolio.
That's great. Peter, thank you so much. I'm glad we had an opportunity to catch up. I know you're very, very busy, and you epitomize "Be You, the World Will Adjust." And it doesn't always adjust right away, but when you stay to being yourself, it will always adjust in the best way to you, because you'll push away those that don't fit and you'll attract those that do fit, because you're genuine and honest. And that's what I've always loved about you. Good luck to you and your partners. Thanks, everybody. My name is Jim Bakiai. The podcast is Be You, the World Will Adjust.